My name's Lisa Dominati. I have the pleasure of introducing Anthony to you guys. I met Anthony a couple of years ago, and we became really good friends. In fact, I was Anthony's sponsor in the very beginning, but I quickly learned that a sponsor is not meant to be a best friend, and we became really good friends. So Anthony moved on to a different sponsor, and now I can pick on him the way I want to. So it is with great pleasure that I present to you Anthony, and there's a wonderful story to be heard. So give it up for Anthony.
All right, my name is Anthony, and I'm an addict. Hey. I hope you all don't mind cussing. Yeah. So I can sing in front of millions of people, but I'm nervous as fuck right now. Yeah. Ooh, man. All right. So can't really fuck it up. It's my story, right?
Right.
All right. So I'm from East Tennessee. I'm the baby of two half-brothers, a stepbrother, and a stepsister. I'm my mom's only child. I was born into a mixed family. My mom's white, my dad's black. So at a very early age, I knew what it felt like not to feel a part of or not to be wanted, because the grandmother on each side of the family let me know where I didn't fit in their family. The black grandmother called me half-breed son of a bitches and told me I wasn't her grandchild, and the white grandmother, I couldn't go in her house till I was 6 years old because I was black and her neighbors would talk. So at an early age, I thought my mom was the only person that wanted me, or that, you know, that I had in life. So in my early years, I lived in the home with both my mom and my dad. I was always different, zesty, if you will. My mama had a family size bag of Skittles when she shipped me out. I've always been a little extra. Childhood was normal for me. The only thing was there was domestic violence in the home. My dad was a whore and liked to fuck anything walking, and when my mom would catch him, he would beat her, and I'd have to watch that. Came home from school one day, and there was a U-Haul backed up in the driveway, and mom was tired of getting her ass whooped. So we moved a little further east. I don't know if I told y'all, I'm from a little town called Dandridge in Jefferson County in East Tennessee. So we moved a little further east, and that's when I thought life would get better, but it drastically got worse. The one person that I thought in my life that I would always have suddenly loved a rock more than she loved me. I can remember bringing like candy bars and stuff like that home to sell for school fundraisers, and she would bribe me with cigarettes to get my fundraiser money, or she would just come and steal it. I can remember getting PlayStations pawned and stuff like that, and one sticks out to me vividly. It was my 10th birthday party, I believe it was, and I had gotten quite a bit of money, and she asked me to borrow it, and I said, no, I want to buy a toy. And she got real pissed off, and she said, fuck you, your birthday and your toy, I'm going to get me an 8-ball. And that's exactly what she did. So I remember going to my mom one day and telling her I was hungry, and there was nothing in the house to eat. There was ashtrays in the freezer and a water pitcher in the refrigerator. And she looked down at me with tears in her eyes, and she said, I can't feed you. And that's been almost 29 years ago, and my mother's not touched crack since. So after that, we stayed in the town we ran a little longer, and then we moved back to our hometown. And that's when life did get better. When my parents split up, my dad went and got his own place. So I had the typical split family home. I had my mom and my stepdad through the week, and I had my dad on the weekends. And the relationship that my dad had with, he had three sons, and we weren't even allowed to call him dad. He would tell us, you know, my name's Nate, you're too big to call me daddy. So the relationship that we had He was a disciplinary, but as far as showing us love, he went to work and paid the bills. But we never, you know, got told I'm proud of you or I love you or anything like that growing up. He showed up when it was time to whoop us for something. So the relationship we ended up having was more like a friendship than a father and a son. We could go to his house on the weekends when we wanted to have house parties and, you know, get drunk and smoke weed and stuff like that. And he would supply what we needed and would leave the house. So as I got up a little older, high school years, they were okay. I was pretty popular with music. I've had some really good opportunities as far as music goes. I sang at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville, recorded in RCA Studios in Nashville, sang with Southern gospel artists. And I'm not saying that to brag. I'm saying that to paint the picture of addiction don't give a fuck what you got going good for you. I was introduced to my drug of choice, which was opiates. When I was about 14, I had wisdom teeth cut out. And I remember my mom took me home because she had to go back to work. And I would take a pill, feel the effect of it, it would knock me out. And I hid the bottle under my pillow. And I would wake up scrambling for it because I never wanted to not feel that fucking feeling again. I finally felt like I mattered. I finally felt like I was important. I finally felt like it didn't matter what the world thought about me. So my dad then had a girlfriend. She was in a pain clinic, so I would steal her hydros and stuff. So I dabbled with small stuff like that. And then the summer between my junior and senior year of high school, I had a cover-up. Some of y'all might know what that means. I hadn't come out to my family yet, so I had a girlfriend. And she was into pretty hard drugs, so that's when my downhill spiral started. Not long after high school, I caught my first of 32 felonies. I needed some more pain pills. I was broke. My parents knew something was going on. They wasn't giving me money. There was a nine in my dad's drawer, and there was a gas station down the street that had a cash register in it. I went in there, and I found out quickly that the state of Tennessee don't like that. They don't like aggravated robbery, apparently. The detectives quickly came to my house to get me. So that landed me in my first treatment center with that charge. It was a faith-based treatment center. We ran a thrift store, and instead of going in there for the right reasons, I was that bitch that looked for the differences in the room. Yeah, I was that one that I only took pills by mouth, so if you smoke crack, we damn sure ain't got nothing in common. And if you done meth, you were the scum of the fucking earth. If you shot heroin, you were a junkie. You know, I was not open-minded at all. I looked for the differences instead of the similarities in the room. I did complete that, did well in the program, and then less than a week after I graduated, I went back home and I was already high. And they say this disease is progressive, so every time I relapsed, I had to find a faster way to feel the effect of the dope. Everything that I said I would never do, I checked that box off. Every way I said I would never do drugs, I checked that box off. I went on another run, ended up catching more charges. I was one of them people that I didn't stop until I had a felony. My brain is wired to think of felonies. I got the bulk of my felonies on this run, but before I caught those charges, I come to this bright idea that it was time for me to come out. I was tired of living a lie. I was tired of lying every time I would leave the house. My mom had this, I lied to my mom and told her that I was with my ex-girlfriend, and we were making things work. The whole time I was with someone else, a guy. So my mom had always told me, if you ever come out and tell me that you're gay, I'm going to disown you. And I'm thinking, how the fuck do you not know? Like, damn. I don't understand. Like, I twitch like a motherfucker when I walk. Like, I don't understand how you don't see this. So I was like, all right, I'm going to tell her. So I get up to go in the living room to tell her, and I get halfway down the hallway and I see her sitting on the couch. And I was like, fuck this. Turned and walked back to my room. I called my aunt and I was like, hey, you need to call my mom and tell her I'm gay. And she was like, what? I said, Jay, it's time. You need to tell my mom I'm gay. I said, and she was like, okay. So I hear the phone ring and I hear my mama say, fuck you and him, bitch, and hung up the phone. And then she hollers for me, Anthony, get in here. And you can knock the fuck out of somebody and that black eye will heal. But you can say some words to somebody and that cuts fucking deep. Yeah. I'm not really going to go into detail about it, but some shit was said that a mother should never say to her kid at all. She wouldn't touch me. She wouldn't hug me. One thing that sticks out that she said was, you fucking make me sick. And what she kept saying over and over again was, you're the only thing that's going to give me a fucking grandkid, and you can't even do that right. What the fuck do I need you for? Yeah. So I left. Come back home after she was in bed, and she wakes me up the next morning. Her crying beside my bed wakes me up, and I roll over and I'm like, what are you doing? And she says, I'm sorry, I don't like it, don't want it in my face, I don't approve of it, but you're still my kid. And at that point, that was enough for me. So in the back of my mind, though, everything that she said was how she felt about me. Every time she would look at me, in the back of my mind, I could still hear every fucking thing that she would say. And I'm a mama's boy through and fucking through. Like, I wouldn't stay with nobody when I was little without beating the fuck out of them, trying to run out the house to get in my mama's car before she left the driveway. Like, psychotically a mama's boy. That fucking crushed me. So what did I do? I went to where I found comfort. Yeah. And I used over that for a long fucking time. But in the reality of it, I hadn't fully accepted myself. Yeah, that was the reality of it. I hadn't fully came to terms with who I was. Because at that point, I couldn't even look at someone and say, hey, I'm gay. I couldn't do it. So in my mom's mind, too, I had painted her a picture of every relationship, whether it be male or female, that I was in, dope was around it. So in her mind, well, maybe you're not gay if you stop getting high. Okay. So life goes on. Go on another run. Then I catch the bulk of my felonies. This time I get sent to prison. I've done classification in Bledsoe in Tennessee. And then went out to West Tennessee to Whiteville. Man. Yeah, people can say what they want to say, but when that fucking fence closes behind you when you drive that little short bus in there, when you shackled up, it's a whole nother world back in there. You gotta basically swim or drown in there. And I'm not gonna stand up here and tell you that prison was the hardest thing in my life. It wasn't. By no means do I want to fucking go back. But you adapt to where you're at. And you survive where you got to survive at. So I did time in West Tennessee. Then they shipped me back to East Tennessee, and I paroled out from Morgan County. And when I came out of prison, when you come out on parole, you got to pass a drug test to come out. I was high the whole time I was in prison. But I made sure that I laid sick for the 2 weeks prior to me taking that drug test so I could come home. But I come out of prison using the needle. And I come out, go meet my parole officer, do good for a while. And a dude that I was in prison with from the same town got out of prison and we started getting high together. Spiral out of control again. Mom kicks me out of the house. And I end up in another treatment center. I completed this treatment center and went to an Oxford house. And I thought that it was a very good idea to trap the Oxford house out. Mm-hmm. So I became the president of the Oxford house, and my room was an addition in the back. So I had my like own little parking area back there, my own entrance to my room. Yeah, it became a drive-through. I had an issue with being attracted to guys that I could fix. If you had mama issues, tattoos, felonies, mental health issues, and you was a drug addict, by God, I wanted you, because I was going to fix you. Yeah. So one of them came in the halfway house. Yeah, he was there a good probably 12 hours, and it was a wrap. He was mine. So we trapped it out. In Oxford, they can vote you out of the house. So they voted me out, and I was homeless on the streets in Knoxville. And to this day, I don't know if the people were intending to kill me or if they just didn't know what they had. But I was around the homeless shelter and did some dope and went through a blackout. My mom told me it was like a 16-day blackout. She said she received several phone calls from the different hospitals in Knoxville that I was there trying to kill myself. I remember the end of the blackout, and I had stayed at the homeless shelter one night, and I got up the next morning and just took off walking, and I ended up in downtown Knoxville. And this part may sound like, you know, I was twacked out of my mind, and I probably still was, but it was real to me. You know those old westerns where there's like tumbleweeds blowing, where there's nobody but just the tumbleweeds? That's how downtown Knoxville looked. I thought the town was shut down and I was the only one in it. So I saw something out of my peripheral, so I walked down the road and walked over, and when I seen his feet, I looked up, and the man looked at me and said, "Anthony, what's wrong?" And this is an example of God doing for me what I could not do for myself. This man had worked with my stepdad at a concrete company in previous years, and I looked up at him and I said, "I need my mama." And he got out the phone, and I heard him say, "Hey, y'all need to come down here and get him. It doesn't look good." So he walked me to his house. My mom come and got me, took me straight from Knoxville to Cincinnati, Ohio, to put me in a Jesus boot camp. Yeah, it's called Life Changers. It's structured after Teen Challenge. If you're not speaking in tongues and rolling in the floor, you're going to hell, and you're going to be a junkie the rest of your life. So 3 months after I was in that program, I get a phone call. And it's my mom on the phone. They come get me out of class. And she said, "Anthony, I don't want to have to tell you this, but your daddy's dead." So I'm in a program where at 6 a.m. when your feet hit the floor, by 6:10, you've got to be on your knees praying, listening to praise and worship music for an hour and a half every fucking morning. And my prayers consisted of, for about 6 months, "Fuck you. You took my fucking dad from me at the time when I needed him the most." So they brought me to Tennessee to the funeral, and it was almost like I was I couldn't stay with my family. I had to stay in a hotel room with a pastor. They escorted me to the funeral, to the burial, and as soon as he was buried, I was back on the interstate going back to Ohio. And looking back now, I can find gratitude in that, because they saved my life. Losing a parent is something that, in my experience, you don't really heal from. I haven't, and it's been almost 6 years. Something broke in me the day I walked in that funeral home, and I had to look down at him. So I went back to Ohio, ended up graduating that program, and became a staff member with them. And then suddenly they got to they got more interested in who I slept with as opposed to how I stay off dope. And they literally wanted to pray the gay out of me. Yeah. they had me at the altar one day, putting oil on my head. We're going to pray the gay out of you. Get the fuck away from me. You're worried about the wrong D. That's what you're worried about. So, yeah, I didn't. I left there, came back home. And in my mind, I had myself tricked that I was in Ohio and my dad was at home. So when I came home, reality hit. And I had no program, no coping skills, no nothing to fall on. I went to his house. He wasn't there. Went down the road to the trap, got a sack of dope, went to the graveyard, and I overdosed for the first time. First fentanyl overdose. So that sent me on a whole nother spiral. Got some more charges, went to jail a few times. And ended up getting a theft charge in another county. My mom had put me out of her house several times in the midst of this. She had found me overdosed in the bathroom and all that stuff, and she was like, you know, you're not going to die in my house. I ended up back in a halfway house in Knoxville, and my mom gets a phone call on July the 27th of 2021. That tells her to come to Fort Sanders Hospital to identify me. Yeah. I was working at the convention center serving banquets, and I'd been clean for like 2 or 3 months, and that compromise set in. Once again, I had no program. Wasn't going to meetings, wasn't calling a sponsor, none of that shit. And that my disease started talking to me. Well, you're going to need some energy. You're working 16 hours a day. One won't hurt. And I did it. So that was at like 9 o'clock in the morning when I first got to work. When I woke up in the ER, there was a sheet over my head, and when I sat up, it was 3:45 a.m. Mom had, they called her around 11 and told her to come to identify me. When I walked out of the back of the emergency room, she hit the floor because she had been sitting there the whole time. They hadn't told her I was alive. They had me listed as a John Doe, and she knew nothing. She thought that she was waiting on the doctor to come bring her back to see me. My stepdad looks at me and he's like, are you done? You're gonna kill your mama. I said, what the fuck are you talking about? I cussed her out for overreacting. Because it was her fault that I overdosed. Yeah. So that still didn't stop me. But what brought me to recovery this last time? I didn't hit on all the parts, but I've been in and out of treatment 14 times. I can write a fucking curriculum for a 28-day program. But that don't mean shit if you don't apply it. Yeah, you can know the book from cover to cover, every piece of literature. That don't mean a fucking thing if you don't apply it. And I didn't apply it. So the theft charge I caught, they put me on probation over that. Who does probation? Not me. I'd done the orientation and that was it. Like, come find me, do your job. So I ran for quite a while on that. And when they finally caught me, I was one of those bathroom bandits that liked to use public restrooms as my personal trap house. And I went in a store, and I blacked out in the bathroom. And when I opened my eyes, I was standing in front of a cop in the county that my warrant was in. So that's another example of God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Getting high got old to me a long time ago, but it became a way of life. It became a way for me to be able to cope with the fact that I didn't like myself. I didn't accept myself. I was in that victim mentality. Oh, poor, poor, pitiful me. I couldn't accept my shit. It was always somebody else's fault. Yeah. So I go to jail for the umpteenth time. And I was so fucked up when I went to jail, they left me in the drunk tank for like 7 or 8 days. And I can remember when I opened my eyes and looked around and seen the concrete of the drunk tank, I had a sigh of relief. Because it was finally over. So I go to court for, they gave me like public intoxication. I gave them a fake name, of course. So they gave me criminal impersonation and possession, simple possession. The only three misdemeanors I have ever had. So they gave me 60 days for that and ordered me to have a drug and alcohol assessment. And for one time in my life, when she done the drug and alcohol assessment, I was honest. Yeah. I finally showed up to save my life. And she started her little spew, and I said, "Can I say something before you go through all that?" I said, "I know how to be abstinent. I know how to quit using. But I don't know a fucking thing about living a life of recovery." And I said, "Abstinence and recovery is two different things. And I don't want to die." At that point, I had overdosed 9 times within a 6-month period. And I told her that. And I said, "I want to live." She said, "Okay, I'm going to send you to CCS in East Tennessee." I said, "No, you're not." "Nope, you're not doing that. That's too close to home." I said, "I need to get out of East Tennessee, or I'm going to die." She said, "All right, what about Buffalo Valley?" I said, "Where the fuck's that at?" And I swear to God, the woman told me, "Hole in the wall." I said, "What the fuck?" I said, "Where's that at?" She said, "Down in Middle Tennessee, somewhere around Nashville." I said, "All right, run it." So, she calls, gets me a bed date, all that shit. Then my lawyer, I heard an addict earlier call him a public pretender. That's just what the fuck they are. Yeah, she came to talk to me about my felony violation, and she said, "This is a real good plan that they got for you." She said, "But you absconded. You ran from them." And the addict in me, I'm like, "No, bitch, I didn't run. They just didn't come get me." She said, "You ran from them, and they don't like that." She said, "So you're probably going to go back to prison and flatten this 4 out." I said, "Oh, okay." So I go back to my little bunk, and for the first time in my life, I didn't pray one of them bullshit jailhouse prayers. Yeah. You know, one of those, "God, if you please get me out of this, I'll never do it again." Yeah, that bullshit. Yeah, for once I got real. And I said, "All right, God, so something along the lines of, if I'm supposed to go back to prison and that is in your will for me, then because of the consequences of my actions, then I know you're going to protect me and be with me while I'm there. But if not, I need you to pave the way for me to go down here to hole in the wall and have a better life." And I had peace about it. Normally, before you go to court, you wringing your hands, pacing, all this other shit. I went to sleep. So I get ready to go to court. The day before my court date, the judge that had been handling my case retired. So there was a new judge. And then the DA that all those pretenders in that county worked with was out with COVID, So they had another one from another county that didn't know none of them. And he was, man, that motherfucker. Woo! He gave somebody 6 months for failing a drug test one time for THC. Yeah. And I was at the end of her stack. And she called my name and she said, Anthony, you're going to Buffalo Valley. And she said, the judge said, if you want to live, you should probably never come back to East Tennessee to live. Run it. So I go to Knoxville to meet that little van. We was packed in there like fucking sardines. It was in the middle of the summer. It was hot as fuck. Man, my motherfucking wig was slipping to the back. I was sweating. I said, God damn. So, this old man was driving, and I was nervous because he kept nodding and bobbing and weaving, hitting them little brrr on the side of the interstate. I said, oh, hell. So we get to Spring Hill, and he totals the van. He hits a deer and totals the fucking van. Yeah. I said, really? Is what you trying to do, God? You didn't let fentanyl take me out, but you gonna let this deer? Then another driver comes and picks us up. I get to Buffalo Valley at like midnight. And I'm from Dandridge. I'm familiar with hollers and all that shit. But fuck, they was driving me back through there. I said, God damn. I was waiting to hear banjos, see some hoods, some burning crosses, and some more shit. So I go in, I do what I got to do, and I already had this mentality of they're against me before I got there. I already victimized myself. Because in my mind, I'm like, I'm a whole nigga with a blonde wig on. I'm going to beat the fuck out these folks. Like, I don't know, you know, like, that's the mentality that I had. But I'm a counselor at that facility today, and I'm still looking for that reason. The other day, we were talking on the front porch about something. We had a client that was saying that they were racist down there, and we was out there talking about it, and I said, listen, if these motherfuckers are racist down here, they hide it pretty fucking good, because I'm in their face every goddamn day. Yeah, I'm still looking for a reason. Like I had my whole life. Yeah, I'm still looking for that reason. They don't give a fuck how long my nails are. They don't give a fuck how blonde the wig is. But what they saw was a broken addict that wanted something different. When I got there, the bitch I seen in the mirror, I fucking hated him. Because every time I was looking in the mirror, I was trying to hit this front vein right here in my neck. Yeah. I was tired of hurting people. I was tired of when people looked at me, I seen disappointment in their eyes. I was tired of people not wanting me around for family functions. Yeah. When I got on that van to come down there, I got on it with the mindset of, I'm not coming back to East Tennessee. Yeah. So, most of the other treatment centers that I had, I could manipulate the fuck out of my counselors. Well, this facility's got addicts as counselors. And they with the shit. They with the shit. Yeah. I went in trying to talk to my counselor one day. And she looked at me and she said, you're full of shit. Come back and talk to me when you get real. Oh, okay. Man. So then I started showing up more for myself. I started applying myself. I started doing what was asked. I shut the fuck up and listened. Because all I did was talk before. I realized that there's another addict that says it all the time, I realized that I didn't know shit about fuck. Yeah. And I allowed people to love me till I could love myself. Yeah. I have friends today. I have people that sometimes just call me just to say I love you. They don't give a fuck who I sleep with. They don't give a fuck what color my skin is. They're not saying, I love you, can you give me $10? I love you, you got a shot. It ain't nothing like that. So at the end of my treatment stint, I was trying to get into the peer program at Buffalo Valley. I interviewed for it, and there was 7 people for 1 spot. I didn't get it. So I told my counselor, I said, look, you're going to figure something out. I ain't going back up there. You got to figure something out. I said, if I go up there, I'm going to get high. So she gave me an extension. And then the guy over the peer program, once again, God looking out for me. Somebody unexpectedly left. And I got a spot. And I'm not giving credit to any specific facility or program or anything like that, but I am saying that that program gave me the opportunity to get a foundation in recovery. Gave me the opportunity to do my 90 and 90, to get a home group, to get a sponsor, to work some steps. Because I didn't have a drug problem. I had an Anthony problem. I have an Anthony problem. I'm still a fucked up individual. Yeah. First through 20 thoughts is wrong. And I probably need to talk to my sponsor, whole network, God, and some more shit about it. But I'm doing the work today to be something different. I can unapologetically be myself today. And I love every part of it. What people think of me is none of my business. And it took me a long time to get to that point. It ain't none of my business. I love me today. And because I love me, I can love others. I can be a friend. I can be a sibling. My parents can have the child they're supposed to have. Today, me and my mom have the best relationship ever. We talk so much, sometimes I get tired of talking to her. And she says now, I don't care if you sleep with a dog, as long as you're clean and you're happy. Man. Yeah. Has it been easy since I got clean? No. On the 11th of February last year, that white grandmother that couldn't stand me because of the color of my skin was on her deathbed. My mom calls me and she says, hey, your mama's dying. The hood in me wanted to say, and? The fuck you want me to do about it? About time. But my program kicked in and I realized that's my mom's mother at the end of the day. I said, okay, do you need me to come home? My mom said, no, but just pray for her. I said, okay. And it didn't set well with me after I got off the phone. So I went to my boss and I said, hey, this is what's going on. I probably need to go home to check on my mom. Absolutely. Here, go. My mama was still in her right mind when I got there. She was awake. I walked over by the bed. As soon as she seen me around the corner, her arms went like this. And I bent down to give her a hug, and she said, Anthony, I know I'm not, we've had a rough road. She said, I know I've not been the perfect mama to you. Before I leave this world, I want you to know that I do love you, and you matter to me. Yeah. Without recovery, I wouldn't have got that. On July the 24th of last year, I get a call at work. My brother's dead from this disease. Yeah. Instead of picking up the phone to call a dope man to come meet me, when I got off the exit in my hometown, I picked up the phone and I called my sponsor and I said, he just called and told me my brother's dead. And it hurts and I don't know what to do. I can deal with life on life's terms today, and I don't have to get high. I'm not a victim of any type of discrimination today that I thought that I was back then. I can accept people where they're at. If that's how they want to be, that's cool. I can love them from a distance. But that don't stop shit from going on over here. Because I'm still that bitch. Yeah. And is. I love me today. I love Narcotics Anonymous. I love the fact that I have a family of a bunch of fucking misfits that get me. Yeah, that get me. I love it. That's all I got. I'm glad to be here.